The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. When historians write about the 2020 pandemic and how it shaped or even dictated technical innovation, they will have no dearth of topics to choose from. They will, however, have the luxury of hindsight, looking at how we reconciled privacy and anonymity with large-scale data collection to further public health. They will also see how we balanced our insistence for individual liberties with pressures to conform for a greater good, or whether, in fact, we reconciled or resolved anything at all. If there is one topic that has pushed debate on almost every angle, it is the topic of vaccines and who did or did not get it. Enter the COVID-19 vaccine passport. Vaccine passports are digital or paper documents that demonstrate if the person in question was vaccinated against COVID-19. These passports are increasingly required as prerequisites for entering private venues, workplaces, and even government offices. U.S. states like California and New York have created official digital credentials that let you verify your COVID-19 immunization record and convert it into a scannable QR code you can pull up and display on your mobile phone. Vaccine passports are also being adopted in Europe. For example, Denmark's government has debuted a digital passport as a way for their citizens to show that they have been vaccinated. The European Union is adopting a digital COVID certificate system for travel that some countries began using as early as June. Even without government mandates, more businesses in countries where vaccines are readily available are starting to ask for proof of vaccination to ensure the health and safety of their customers and employees, so long as their local governments do not forbid them from doing so. Employers such as Amazon and Shopify, and entities as varied as hospitals to hotels and airlines, require vaccine passports. Vaccine passports may become a norm for travel. For example, Etihad Airline and Emirates started using a digital travel pass developed by the International Air Transport Association to help passengers manage their travel plans and provide airlines and governments documentation that they have been vaccinated or tested for COVID-19. Of course, as with any form of official documentation, forgeries are already a step or two ahead. According to the FBI, paper vaccine passports can be bought on WhatsApp and Instagram for as little as $100 per card. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection alone has seized more than 3,000 fake vaccine cards in recent months. In Italy, the government had to ask the popular messaging platform Telegram to shut down selling fake vaccine certificates. Fake digital vaccine passports are not far behind. Leaving the issue of forgeries aside, there are real debate on the privacy and data collection dilemmas these passports pose. Digital rights and privacy advocates are sounding the alarm on normalizing sharing private health data simply to eat at a restaurant, or having to have your mobile phone scanned and thus tracked by entities as varied as governments to small enterprises just to enter venues. If we were to go back to the future, how would we discern the consequences of actions we take now in the name of protecting public health? How would we redesign our systems or set appropriate policy safeguards in place to balance individual rights with public welfare? And how would we distinguish real threats from the hypothetical?
Our guest today is Bernard Benamou. Bernard is an internet governance and digital policy expert and advisor to the French government. He is a founding member and technology advisor of Planet Finance, an internet-based NGO devoted to giving microcredit to developing countries. Bernard is also a senior lecturer at the Institut d'études politiques de Paris and at the Panthéon Sorbonne. Since 2015, he has been Secretary General of the Institute for Digital Sovereignty. The Institute's mission is to educate and mobilize citizens and their representatives on the issues of digital sovereignty and to propose technical, legal, and political measures to assert an individual's digital sovereignty over his or her digital assets, in particular, in order to preserve individual and collective freedoms. Welcome, Bernard.
Welcome to you too, and thanks for having me.
So this is a little bit of a deep dive back into the COVID space. Over a year ago, Alexa and I did a couple of podcasts on the subject that was then sort of the intertwining of technology and COVID, namely the whole issue of contact tracing. So now here we are 18 months later, and the pandemic of 2020 is the pandemic of 2020 and 2021. Sigh.
And sadly, 2022.
Yeah. I'm not ready to go there. Let's look at what is the current hot topic, namely the issue of vaccine passports. And can you set the scene for us a little bit first? Can you tell us a bit about what is considered a vaccine passport in the EU, and how is it issued? How is it verified?
Yes, the idea is, for here, we are talking about COVID passport, not vaccine passports, because, for example, for France, we are dealing with a system which is also including tests for right. people to show that they had a test in the few hours before. And until very recently, the tests were free for all citizens to do it again and again, and will change. It's about to change now. So it's not about seeing who is vaccinated only. It shows that, but it's not the only goal. And indeed, since you mentioned that you have been talking about contact tracing in the past, and I listened to your podcast about that a few months ago, at that time, the question was about contact tracing, what about knowing how the virus is expanding in our societies in Europe. Now it's completely different. The same tool, and we could talk, and I guess we will talk about foreign experience outside the EU and outside US and Canada. For example, the Chinese has been the first to have a COVID system, especially for transmitting and contact tracing on a very rigorous base. But for us now, it's completely different. It's a political tool to not impose, but to influence people to get vaccinated. Because if you have the COVID pass, you can go to places without difficulties and traveling soon. This indeed is alarming the people from rights and human rights organizations. But basically, the other choice we had was shutting down France, as it has been happening two times already. So in a way, it's a change. It was a medical tool at first, and it becomes now a political influence tool on second. And I completely agree with you. There are privacy issues that are not completely solved. For example, very recently, the application in France that is collecting those COVID passports for people have been accused of being negligent on how they deal with the statistics of people, and it could retrace how people are meeting in the same place and so on. So we are opening something. I would not say Pandora's box, but in a way it is. We are opening something that could lead to very nasty consequences, to borrow the title of your podcast, and tech consequences and political consequences in that matter can has to be pondered very, very seriously. And I guess we are just in the beginning of it, and we will have to talk and to consider those issues on a long term, because we are almost sure that we will live with the virus for more than 1 year. And we will have vaccine, new campaigns, booster shots, possibly variations on the vaccine, and so on. So indeed, now the push is political. Soon there will have to be a deep thinking on the consequences of that.
Yeah, so thanks for the clarification about it being a COVID passport, because I think that's an important, certainly an important aspect, because it's about, it's meant to be certifying what a person may or may not have the right to do. And that could be based on both whether you're vaccinated or whether you have a recent negative test or whatever else. But it strikes me that these are the things that actually vary from region to region. You know, both the requirements, you know, what kind of tests are permitted, even what kind of vaccinations are permitted. I mean, we're seeing a little of that between the US and Canada, because it wasn't exactly the same sets of vaccines that were approved for use in both countries. So what have you seen in terms of, you know, adoption across the EU and or variability from region to region?
Indeed, I have to go back to the root, the COVID passport, as it has been created by the by the European Commission is not supposed to centralize data.
Right.
The data has to stay in each member state, which is important, which is not enough in terms of privacy for many reasons, but which is important. And indeed, the idea was to maintaining some possibilities of transfer and travel between the EU countries, even if we are not back to the usual non-control policy of the EU. And I guess we have seen how fragile those transfer between different countries could be in times of pandemics. So basically, it was that. We have, as you said, different policies in Europe about the vaccines, the kind of vaccines, the duration of vaccines before you can benefit from the COVID and so on. So each one is going at its own pace on that. But basically, there is a common tool. And what is interesting is that when you have the QR code for in each country, you can transform it in a European format and standardize QR code after. And this one allows you to present to any country you go in. But those are different codes at first. And about the adoption, indeed, there are great differences. Also due to the fact that there are great differences in vaccine policy in different European countries. For example, our neighbors of the south, Portugal, Spain, have a skyrocketing campaign of vaccination that we are very impressed, amazed by them. And some other countries in the north and other countries in the east are not as vaccinated. So the necessity, as I said earlier, the necessity to push people to go to get the vaccine, to have the vaccine, is not the same. For Portuguese or for Spanish, there is no need to make any campaign. So the push to use that kind of passport is not the same unless you want to go in other countries. So you see,
right.
the political situation is really different. It's not, even if the figures seems to be homogeneous, they are not. They are not. And situations are very different in the north and in the south.
And here they're very different in the north and the south. I have family in Quebec, so I was anxious to get to visit them and took the opportunity to visit them very briefly in July, at which point I was vaccinated, but it was before Quebec had instituted its form of vaccine passport or COVID passport. And now to make that visit, I could go, but even to, when you stay in a hotel, you eat in restaurants, whatever, I would have to present proof of living somewhere other than Quebec and proof of vaccination. And all I have is a handwritten card that was written on the day of the days of
written
vaccination.
Card.
A handwritten card. Okay, it gets better. I have a handwritten card, which they duly typed into their system. But, I was on my own doctor's, the medical center's website recently looking at my own medical records, and they're not aware that I'm vaccinated. So, I mean, an instance of the data not traveling where it needs to be.
Yeah, I have to plead. I don't know the Canadian system very well, but I know they've been very strict on quarantines and so on. I've had friends who went in Toronto and who said 14 days in a place without going out and so on and so on.
Yep.
That's something that's precisely the difficulties with politics intersection with technology. Because we don't have the same reactions to that kind of device. In the very beginning in France, when we were talking about COVID passport, people said, never, ever this will exist here. Same was true about contact tracing, which was not an obligation, but which was adopted with a lot of campaigns and so on, and which didn't work. We could talk about that because I remember when I listened to your podcast a few months ago that there were doubts about the efficiency of those systems and technologies, and maybe it was a little bit too early for a massive adoption about it. But globally, we see now that we are pushing back the boundaries of what we considered the acceptability of those technologies in public. And it's not a good thing, to be completely honest. We published recently a report on the Internet of Things and digital sovereignty, where we quote an example by a large consulting firm, which was advocating for a worldwide network of sensors everywhere in the world to create early detection system for new pandemics. And the people writing that proposal said, oh, people will say that it's not good in accordance to our values of democracy and so on, but leaders have to go beyond those kind of objection, and they have to adopt that, which will create the largest market ever for the Internet of Things. So they were talking in a way that was really, and it was American or British firm, I can check, but basically they were saying, okay, democracy is a variable d'ajustement, system with which we can tamper with. No, never.
Yeah, you mentioned about how this is an intersection of technology and policy. It is also an intersection of technology and science. Ultimately, this vaccine COVID-19 passports is intended to show proof of immunization as a way to say that this person is safe, is this person is not going to transmit that disease, or is not going to be a super spreader, at least. The problem, though, seems to be that we know so little still about this disease that there are differing guidelines, for example, from the WHO to the CDC to even the White House about how many booster shots we need, you know, who needs the booster shots, and how long does it take before your immunity actually starts to taper off. So unfortunately in a pandemic, now we've got a device that is supposed to be based on scientific grounds. And I know that everybody is trying to make sure that this is based on scientific data. However, there are differences in that. And as you said, now we've got issues of, you know, technology and then policy debates coming into the place. So how do we reconcile that? I mean, if the purpose of these vaccine passports is to show immunity, but we cannot agree on what actually constitutes human immunity. Human immunity doesn't depend on borders, France, Germany, UK, Canada. So isn't the fundamental premise flawed then?
I'm not a specialist of infectious disease, so I will not try to pose as one. That's the current disease in most European countries and many others in the West, people talking about things they don't really know. So I will keep it to politics and maybe a little about technology. What we know is that people can transmit the virus even if they have had the vaccine. Mm-hmm. That's why some people and conspiracy theorists say it's not a vaccine. Look, people can transmit. So it's only reduce the most severe case, and it's not preventing the spreading of the disease, which is not completely sure. I've heard, and I'm not an expert, that it reduced the transmission, even if it's not completely avoiding it. So in a way, you're very right, Alex. Basically, we are talking about science in progress. We are talking about things we didn't know. We are talking about a process of creating a vaccine in a record time, like never before. When I was a student, we talked about 10 years to test and develop vaccines and so on. So basically, indeed, science and technologies are not dealing with certainty. And you know, as I do, that politicians love to deal with certainty. And citizens, especially in times of crisis, love to deal with certainty. And why are we talking so often about conspiracy theory, about disinformation? Because there is room for that. There is room for that. Look, Israel, which has been presented at first as the most efficient country in terms of vaccination, is having the necessity now of a booster shot, like you mentioned. And basically, we have the same happening everywhere about the Delta, I hope not about the mu, not about maybe one day the omega virus. I don't think so, but I don't hope so. But basically, we are having a pure case, a chemically pure case of responding to a crisis with new tools, both technologically, medically, and politically. And what is very new and very interesting for those who have been, like I've been, in cabinet office and ministers and so on, is that we have a tool that allows people to compare what's happening in Russia, what's happening in Europe, not what's happening in China, because all the figures are wrong about China, but what's happening in the US and different states, often with open data systems, which allows direct comparisons. That's something that never happened ever, even in economics. Here we have the possibility, highly political possibility, to measure the efficiency of regimes, and it pushes even more pressure. It gives new tools for citizens, new tools for disinformation as well, to look, oh, look, it's not happening fast enough because we have this and that, and so on. But it also gives new ways to react to political statements and political measures, and that's for those involved in those issues, that's fascinating. That never happened in the past, never.
One of the things that, you know, that seems to be apparent about the concerns around having COVID passports of any description, and when the notion was first floated about vaccine passports in this country in earlier this year, several states, about a dozen states, immediately rushed to have regulations banning the possibility of ever having that sort of thing in their state for their own political ends. But one of the sort of legitimate concerns about this sort of thing is that it's just one step towards, you know, assigning values to us or giving us basically, you know, labeling people. And you can say that.
And a lot was talking about the sign of the beast in the past when we were talking about RFID tags and so on.
Yeah.
We are living in a strange time where people are massively obliged or accepting those kind of tools. And if you ask me if we are getting closer to a minority report, yes, we are. Yes, we are. You know that the physicists have a clock about atomic risk and the minutes before the possible, the midnight.
Yep.
We are having a lot of minutes if we do the same for privacy. And we are getting closer to midnight on privacy every day. That's true. That's very true. And that's why those questions have to be observed and discussed and debated between lawmakers, but also with citizens, even if those can be highly technical issues. It's like bioethics. I followed the bioethics debates in the past. You have fascinating discussions, but it was closer to people's lives. It was easier, for maybe a little bit easier to understand, but we have to make that kind of education for citizens to understand in what society they want to live, and if they want to be between Minority Report and Gattaca, or in a more civilized way to live. And that's precisely, I guess, the debates we will have in Europe soon about what kind of preservation of freedom we want, what kind of privacy, what kind of human rights, what kind of social policy, and so on and so on. And indeed, those technology could lead to very scary, and we try not to be too pessimistic and too gloomy about that, but those technology could lead to gloomy scenarios soon. Indeed, that's why we have to talk and debate and educate about that.
So you talked about China and about the atomic clock. It strikes me that we are almost at the stage, maybe in our human existence, where we have to make a decision, you know, about whether we want to look out for collective health or our individual, you know, liberties. A lot of the discussion in the US around vaccines, around masks, have been around, you know, individual liberties. And the counter side to that has been, well, what about the impact on the greater good, impact on herd immunity? And if you think about it from a cultural perspective, you know, the Western versus the Eastern view, the Western view is really individual first. And the Eastern view is looking at society first and the individual in the service of society. So isn't this all coming to a head at some point where we as a people of this planet have to reconcile, well, which is it? Are we going to look out for the furtherance of the species and how we collectively live together? Or are we going to still insist on having rights that may not be manifestedly appropriate now in a world where we are dealing with climate change and pandemics that affect all of us?
Wow, you had a good morning. Sorry.
To answer
or a bad night.
in 20 seconds. No, those are very deep and very important questions indeed, Alexa. Are there risks to have a kind of tech dictatorship in the future? Yes, fully. Are there risks to have an eco-dictatorship in the future? Yes, as well. And maybe the same. And maybe they will intersect between fighting global warming and reducing emissions and having technology control about health and activities and micromanagement of people behavior, like my distinguished colleague Shoshana Zuboff has been heavily talking about in her book about the age of surveillance, of surveillance capitalism. Basically, yes, there are. And if we don't have those debates before those technologies are widely spread in the society, then we will have no tools, I mean political tools, ideological tools, to refute or to change the outcome of those evolutions. So I fully agree with you. The risk is there. And the risk is there because there are just a bunch of pundits, us, those, the usual suspects talking about technology and society and politics, who are aware of those risks, and the others who are simply not questioning what the governments are saying. You mentioned China. What is interesting about China is they are having what people in poker call a bold-faced lie. They are saying to the world, we have had 4,000 deaths. And don't mention that you're not agreeing with our figures. You have to believe that. In the single city of Wuhan, where the virus is supposed to have been originating, it's impossible that they had only 4,000 deaths. Don't right. ask for a 1.4 billion people country. That's
statistically insignificant.
Yeah, it's impossible. So basically, you have countries playing the game of a certain level of transparency. Don't think that I'm completely sure that we are transparent, either in the US or in Europe, but at least a certain level of it. Do we need more? I agree, we need more. Do we need tools for people to control the public policies in that field? Indeed, we do. Do we need something more? Do we need politicians, political leaders, lawmakers who are shaping the way for the, let's say, 20 years, not 100 years from now? We don't know. In the long run, we're all dead. But on the middle term, we could discuss that. And indeed, we need to craft a society where some of the values we consider the core of the European non-discrimination, freedom. And I agree with you, Alexa. People are a lot talking about freedom of not wearing masks. And indeed, I agree with you. Freedom of not wearing masks is freedom to kill people that will get the virus because you're not wearing masks. So there is a balance to be established.
So just to be clear, although I teased Alexa about about her sunshiny and cheerful characterization of things. it's as much because I fully agree with her. I think that she, that was a very clear articulation of something that I'm concerned about as well. And I think we can also look at it in terms of, there's a lot in this country, the US, there's a lot of concern about individuality and ability to express, you know, individual rights. But it also happens at the national level as well, right? I mean, I think you see that in the EU, that although the European Commission can lay out general guidelines, each individual country will adopt and adapt them as appropriate to the country.
Yeah, we are not a federation yet. Maybe we will be at some point, but we are not. So indeed, right, there are differences in the different member states' politics about that.
And if we're at a point where people are not necessarily believing in vaccines, and we're already rushing to the point where we're using these passports as a tool to try to get people to get vaccinated in order to simplify their own lives, it seems to me that maybe we're just building up a very unstable structure of argumentation for why these things are important, right? And maybe the better plan would be to say, look, why do we actually need to have something like a vaccine or a COVID passport? What problem does it actually solve other than making, you know, decreasing friction for those who are vaccinated? You have a driver's license because it demonstrates that you have had some level of instruction, you have some level, demonstrated some level of competency, and should therefore be presumed to be safe to operate your vehicle. And it can be revoked if you demonstrate otherwise. So when do we get to that level with something like a COVID passport? What are the bars there? And is that something that makes it worth trading off our individual privacy for?
We have to wonder if those passports are here to stay. And sadly, what we see, and without thinking about possible variants, the mu or the omega or the theta or whatever, we are supposed to think it can last. Do we want that? No. Can we avoid it? I'm not sure. And that's the problem is there. Do we need to create new situation and new protection for those data not to be stored or not to be stored for a long time, for those data not to be exchanged? And it's a complicated matter because there are conflicting agendas. The scientists want to have all the data to be able to analyze the situation. And how, for example, in France, we do have a lack of information out of how the different variants are spreading because we don't sequence enough of the genomes of all the tests. It's very costly. And in some countries, people are sequencing a lot of those viruses and not. So indeed, scientists want to have all. They are like NSA. They want to have all information. But at some moment, with different goals and different agendas, indeed. I'm just joking. But basically, we have to create situations where we can have research and we are having some tests and some legal framework for that in Europe, especially the Data Governance Act, DGA, which precisely try to manage information for being used in one single purpose and not to be reused against the people. I've been the one, for example, on a completely different matter, talking to the energy system people in France, the people who created smart meters in France, saying, your smart meters is about to create something that could allow religious and ethnic discrimination. They said, no, it's impossible. We're just measuring what people... The level of consumption of a household. And I said, yes, but you can see during the Ramadan for the Muslims or during the Shabbat for the Jews that they are consuming differently. And then you can have your consequences or your deductions about that. The same can be true about medical data, even more. You in the US were about to have a completely minority report mixed with Gattaca-like law, which was named H.R. 1313. and which was about to oblige everyone to have a DNA sequencing in their business, in their companies. It was proposed by the Trump administration. It was blocked gladly by the Congress after the midterms, indeed. But it was a proposal, and the people who would not comply would have to pay $4,000 or $5,000 a year of penalty.
What was this DNA sequencing for?
It was for preventing chronic disease. It
oh,
was,
wow.
Oh yes, HR 1313. I wish
wow.
you all to look at that text.
I did not know about that.
Yes, I'm glad. We are talking about large measures of medical screening and so on. This is the temptation we have. This is not even a temptation anymore in China. It's happening. They have the social credit, and now they have the genetic credit. They are sequencing 700 million males of the population, which allows them to create a complete map, genetic map of the country. That is scary.
That is scary, yeah.
And that's precisely why those debates about COVID have to be understood in the technological evolutions. Because those genetic sequencing systems are becoming cheaper and cheaper every day. And those technologies will exist and will be proposed as a way, for example, to analyze and prevent chronic disease to happen in people and to mitigate risk. And you know, indeed, how insurance companies are eager to mitigate the risks about people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is actually quite scary, the whole idea of being able to, you know, as attractive as it is in terms of data collection and insight into the population, to be able mm-hmm. to actually predict how your genome might impact your risk levels for insurance and maybe insurance coverage has longstanding consequences.
Particularly since we really don't have, we aren't actually very good at making those kinds of predictions, right? I mean, there's what we understand these things mean today, but it's not a complete picture. We've seen that however many times.
Yeah. I keep coming back to the fact that, you know, a lot of times we put in mechanisms in play to make up for the fact that we don't have scientific literacy. You know, science is not about absolutism. It's not about certainty. It's really about having the bulk of the evidence be on one side versus the other, you know, even if it is 99.999 versus that one, you know. But I almost, for some of these vaccine critics, I sometimes want to ask, okay, whoever survived the smallpox or diphtheria, please stand up. Or polio. Oh, you didn't. Okay, because your parents actually got vaccinated and those who didn't did not survive. And hence, you are the generation that has benefited from that science. Not having scientific literacy, we have to put in mechanisms in place to track and to try to encourage people to get vaccinated. That has all these other consequences. Anyhow, Bernard, this has been a really eye-opening discussion. And thank you for alerting us to the law that did not pass. Thankfully, I did not know about that, which tells you how.
There was a lot of stuff going on then.
Yes.
A lot of temptation to go toward Minority Report or Gattaca or a mix of both.
I'm sure people are going to be looking up those movies again. I will. Bernard, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for being on our podcast.
A pleasure.
Thanks to you both. My pleasure too.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.